Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Bradley Palmer, and on this episode of the show, I am joined by Jeremy Fisk and Mr. Michael McCann. This week, we went and saw the new Steve McQueen, Michael Fassbender film, Shame. We'll merge into a discussion on if directors can be considered auteurs after only a couple films. And then we'll wrap everything up with our top five films about addiction.
I can see you're very successful. You know, I think part of the secret to my success is attention to detail.
And, detail?
Yeah.
Play the game.
What game?
Okay, blue or green?
I like games. I like this game, blue. Green, green, it's green. That's brown. I don't know how you change the color of your eyes like that. How do you do that so quickly? That's amazing. That's amazing. It's a real talent.
Detail.
Hey, buddy. Hey, detail. This guy right here nailed it today. I want you to know this guy nailed it. You're the man. Your pitch, amazing. Amazing. Listen, we're playing a game here. Close your eyes again. Blue, green.
Brown.
Huh? All right, you. Hey, Warren. Come on, close your eyes.
Blue.
Blue.
That's you. Just making that up. He's just picking colors randomly.
You can have this shot.
You know what? Excuse me. You need another shot, please?
You can put these on me.
No, I told
Thank
you.
No, I haven't.
I'll get the next one.
Sure.
You're a strong, independent woman. I like
Thank
that.
You.
I like
cheers.
That. Listen, cheers.
Nailing it.
It's nailing it.
So this week we went and saw Steve McQueen, the director, not the deceased actor's second feature film, Shame. His first feature film was Hunger, which also starred Michael Fassbender, and we'll get into a discussion of his movies a little bit later. But Shame dealt with the very tricky subject of sex addiction. And I say it's a very tricky subject because it's something people don't really want to talk about. It's not something people want to maybe even acknowledge, but I am really glad that this movie decided to wrestle with this topic because, and this is where it gets tricky because I don't know how much, and me and Michael last night, because we went to the movie together, we sort of said, it's going to be a tough podcast because we don't know how much we're going to reveal on this podcast about our sort of generation's expectation when it comes to sex and pornography and all this stuff that nobody really else has dealt with or nobody else really now wants to talk about. But that was the subject of this movie, of Shame, was dealing with that. And obviously, Brendan's, Michael Fassbender's character, was an extreme version. But it puts out this sort of idea of the modern sort of male and what he has to deal with in our society when it comes to sex. And are you guys, do you guys feel the same way I felt as far as that this movie was brave in dealing with that subject matter? And did it do a good job?
Yeah, I think it did. And this does seem like the last taboo we have in the same way that, you know, homosexuality went on in the 50s or 40s and so forth, and I think still does today. In the same way that no one talked about it in those days, it seems like this is really the last thing that's, like, clearly it's going on, people are too afraid to even try to bring it up. Where would it be appropriate to bring it up anyway?
I think part of the fear has to deal with it's such an introverted sort of individualized problem that if somebody is dealing with this in whatever shade they're dealing with it, whether it's just, you know, internet porn or the extreme that Fassbender's character goes to here with, you know, prostitutes and even, you know, well, we won't spoil anything, but eventually, you know, no one really wants to talk about it. If you're dealing with it, then you're dealing with it, and that's your thing. But I think in modern-day society, I think it's a discussion that needs to be had, and it's a discussion that Steve McQueen and Michael Fassbender and everyone involved in this movie could clearly, in some way, see that there's a problem and something we need to talk about, and that's what they projected out there. And for the most part, I think they did a really good job of it. And it's not like I was saying, as far as it being introverted and individualized, it's not a subject that easily translates as a film. And that was the challenge for Steve McQueen, and that was the challenge for this film, was showing the problems that this may cause cinematically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it dealt with a subject that I think, like you said, is not necessarily cinematic and is not necessarily, doesn't lend itself to narrative completely.
Yeah, storytelling in general.
Yeah, so, no, I just agree with that.
And I don't want to toot our own horn here, Brantley, but there was a little bit of this sort of loneliness grabbing or being sort of driven to technology and the glow of sexuality on the computer that we dealt with a little bit in Through the Woods.
Oh, yeah, well, we're just obviously ahead of our time.
Way ahead of our time.
Of course. And now Steve McQueen obviously somehow saw a copy of the film.
Well, it's around. There's copies out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know what? Those guys were right.
Yeah. And I think we can honestly say that we were an influence on Steve McQueen in the making of this film.
In the making of Shame. Except for we were too embarrassed to really go all out with it and show what he showed in Shame. And that brings up the point of this movie being NC-17. And, you know, most movies being NC-17 is sort of looked at as a very negative thing as far as getting audiences in. But I don't think they cared with this movie, because this movie wasn't going to generate a big box office. It was it's definitely one of those sort of, you have to seek it out indies, whether it was rated R or NC-17.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it made any difference to the box office of this film.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, I went and we saw this at Kendall, which is the only place it's really showing around here in Boston. And mm-hmm. I mean, in my showing, which was the very first showing on Friday, it was like 1 o'clock. The theater was pretty well attended. You know, certainly not packed to the gills.
A lot of first dates.
Yeah, a lot of first dates, of course. You know, but I mean, you don't really get too much of that packed to the gills with, like, independent movies anyway. I think really only Black Swan was the only, like, other independent movie at the Kendall I went to, and, like, it was really packed in the theater. Actually, the first time we went to see it, the first showing we wanted to see was sold out. We were like, are you serious? And so we had to come back again. But, I mean, yeah, I don't think really that the NC-17 affected its box office either, because, like you said, it's an independent movie that people were going to have to seek out anyway. So people who wanted to see it knew they wanted to see it and were going to find it no matter what the rating was.
All right, so we've broached that we were, you know, as mid-20 American males, that the subject matter of this film is something that needs to be talked about, or something that, you know, is very taboo and cliche. Taboo and something that people don't want to speak of. But was the film effective? Did you guys, and we're going to be talking about Steve McQueen as a director in a little bit, and what he likes to do as far as these sort of long takes, whether they're long static takes like there was at the date scene on this, or long tracking takes like when he's running. Did this style bode well to portray the drama, the sort of human emotion that came out of this film?
I think it. I did a little research before watching this movie, and I feel like a lot of people came back to the question of whether or not it deserved or earned the title Shame as its title, and whether or not it really demonstrated that effectively. And I think it did.
As far as what? As far as the character being shamed, or?
Yeah, whether or not the movie really engenders within us a sense of shame about the whole situation.
Right.
And I think it did. I think every scene had that theme in it. If it was just, you know, like his date that he goes on, there was like kind of just that sort of mundane sort of shame about, you know, how, you know, our lives are just sort of, you know, done. I feel like when he was on his first date, you know, it certainly scenes like that reeked of that kind of mundane sense of shame that we have every day when we just sort of mechanically go through crap that we have to go through every day. And I think the long sort of shots and scenes helped lend to that as well. And even the, you know, the sort of, whether, you know, whether it was over the top or whether it was just a little extreme compared to what we're normally seeing in movie scenes, those scenes as well, I think, were metered enough that they carried through the theme of shame without just being over the top and raunchy for no reason.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Brantley.
Oh, okay. No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think the film is very effective in just showing, like, the downward spiral of somebody in an addiction. I mean, and I don't think it really... I think sex addiction kind of is probably the first time it's really being shown in this way on screen. I mean, I might be wrong about that, but I think they really... Steve McQueen and Michael Fassbender do a really, really great job of just showing a man who is just broken. You know, he's just a broken man, and I think that they do an unbelievable job of showing this downward spiral that he goes through with this addiction.
I think it's good they didn't. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just gonna say. I think what was effective about this film was really all dependent on Carey Mulligan's character, because she was the one that sort of threw this wrench into Michael Fassbender's Brandon's life, as far as he had to then take a look at himself and what he was doing, because she was staying with him. And what's interesting, and maybe why this sort of subject matter is more taboo, is because he could have kept going and kept doing exactly what he was doing without sort of any external huge ramifications. He could have got up, he could have gone to work, he could have came back, he could have done what he was doing, lived his life, and really, he would never have to be faced with that sort of introspective, what the hell am I doing with my life moment, until Carey Mulligan's character, who plays his sister, has to stay there, and then he has to sort of realize how damaging this stuff is and what he is doing to himself. And I think the way that Abby Morgan and Steve McQueen, who are the screenwriters of this, bounce those two characters off each other was effective, but it was also sort of like, you want to know what their past was between the brother and sister, and we can get into the sort of the incestual you know, scenes that were in this movie, but I guess what I'm trying to say is Carey Mulligan's character was, I think, key to Michael Fassbender's character sort of figuring out, if he ever does figure out, what the hell is going wrong in his life.
Yeah, I think Carey Mulligan is his one, like, emotional link in the world, and, like, he sees her sing, and he gets a little misty there at the restaurant, and it's, like, the only time we see him, like, he gets a little angry a lot of times when they're together, so it's, like, the rest of his life is kind of mechanical, and he's not that demonstrative emotionally unless he's with her. So she definitely adds an interesting dynamic to that world and is sort of the linchpin for him coming to some kind of change in attitude about what he does in his life.
Now, did you guys ever, and this was maybe what I disliked a little bit, not disliked, but just I wanted it more in this movie, is to sort of have those moments where it just hit me, like, where it struck me, you know, to a human core, what this guy was going through, and also feel it myself. I felt, even though, you know, this whole time I've been talking about how important, you know, having this discussion is, I never really got that, oh, you know, I get it. Like, I get what he's, not necessarily from personal experience, but just from a, you know, a human aspect, like, oh, I feel for him moment.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I don't know how you would achieve that without some kind of sort of clumsy explanation or prescription for why he has become this way.
Right. And they did know,
which
very,
I was glad they did.
Yeah, they really tried to avoid any sort of, this is not about what happened in the past, this is not about how he became, either of them became who they are, which you can sort of hint to maybe some sexual abuse as children, and hence the sort of incestual scenes we saw. They were very, very self-conscious about not having those scenes of, oh, I'm this way because, and I think that's a really, really important for this movie to be effective, that they didn't do that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think I admire about it is that it even leaves the possibility that there is no reason why he's like this, and maybe he's not even, well, I'm going to say this and someone's going to maybe disagree with me, but maybe he's not even really damaged, maybe. I mean, I feel like people have always been like this, but it's just that we now have technology and different apparati to explore and, express those things that, right. Have never existed before. So I think it's maybe just saying there's nothing potentially really that wrong with him. It's just that it's unfortunate the way things have changed, and this is a possible outcome for people now.
I could not agree more, and I think you nailed what I've been trying to say for the last 30 minutes. Is
you sound like the boss guy when they're out drinking. He's like, this guy nailed it today.
He nailed it today. No, but that's what I mean. Like, I think that it's hinted at that there could be some sexual abuse or some problems in the child, their past, if the audience member and the theater goer and who's ever watching this movie wants to project that to them and say the only reason he's like this is this. But then you can also say, no, it's never, maybe this is just, he's just a product of the time and product of his environment and a product of the availability of this stimuli, and there's nothing really wrong with him. And you know what? This happens. We have to look at this as a potential issue in our society, and I think that's where this movie really shines and gets it right.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree with you that I think the movie makes a statement about it not necessarily being about his past. It's more just about him now in the present. But I don't think it really says that there's not anything wrong with him. You know what I mean? Because
not anything wrong with him in the sense that like there's a reason for this to happen. I mean, there's clearly something wrong with him. There's clearly something damaging about him. But we're not saying there's like, oh, this is fine. This is fine behavior. But we're saying that there's not necessarily a reason, a big, like, he was sexually abused sort of reason for him to do this. This could just be because he could have these issues just because of, where he's living in New York City, being the bachelor, and the art society sort of ability to get this, like I said, this sort of stimuli.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. It was coming across as if earlier that like it sounded like maybe you guys were talking about like he didn't actually have a problem, because I think one thing this movie does really well is is show how much that the issue of sex addiction affects him in so many ways, and how much it just tears him up inside. So, I mean, if there's one thing the film does, it's that,
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And I'm glad you made that clear, because he certainly has an issue. But what's interesting about this movie, and without really spoiling anything, is we talk about how effective it is that these things are sort of, when Carey Mulligan, his sister, her character comes and visits Brendan, that his world gets sort of turned upside down. He has to deal with the problems that he has created for himself. But this movie also has to, and maybe it's because it is a movie, and maybe because they felt like maybe it would be too boring otherwise, but it does go to a point in this film where there are some extremes that maybe the film didn't need to portray what it was portraying. And I think specifically of when he goes to the gay club, and specifically what the end result of Carey Mulligan's character is. If both those areas were taken out of this movie, would we still have a film effective enough? Or did the filmmakers feel like, okay, no, you know what, to really hammer home my point, I'm gonna put these two extreme scenes into the movie?
I can't come up with a reason why it, or pinpoint why they should be removed or anything. I mean, I just considered them like an extra flourish that didn't really, I guess really didn't add or subtract anything for me. It was just like kind of extra interesting stuff to note. But
these are big things. These are a guy going against his sexuality and a girl who, you know, without spoiling anything, really takes her life in her own hands.
Well, I just want to point out, we don't necessarily know he's going against his sexuality. We hadn't seen it before, but right. he might just be such a sex addict that, and I think the film kind of points out in that scene that he doesn't really care where that's, it's coming to if he's aroused enough in that moment.
Yeah, no, that's my point, is I don't think he is a gay man, but I think he's just such a sex addict that it doesn't, like, is that, not to repeat exactly what you said, but yeah.
So you would get rid of that scene, you think?
You also, Mike, you were, that's what you said, you know, coming out of this movie.
But I was drunk. No, I did say...
The answer is yes, I would get rid of that scene, but...
It does seem...
Does it hammer... Like, do we not know at that point he has such a problem that we need that scene?
I think that scene is used to just really highlight the spiral that he's going down. And, you know, it's coming after he can't get into another club that, you know, he's trying to get into, presumably to find a woman. Right. And so he's so down on his, you know, down on himself and you know, horny at that point that he's willing to do just about anything. And I think that's kind of just what it highlights, is that spiral that he's going through, down.
Maybe in retrospect, I would get rid of that, only because as well handled as other ambiguities in the film were handled, I feel like that's the one thing that's maybe a little too vague what they're trying to indicate with him going there. It's like, is the director saying that heterosexuals could have those impulses anyway? Is it saying that he's actually gay and the sex addiction is some sort of massive cover-up for those innate feelings? Or, I mean, it just seems almost like too much ambiguity to add on at that point.
All right, so we've been talking a long time, but I really, really want to get to Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan and what you guys thought of their performances. Do you consider these very, because they were both, you know, for lack of better words, very exposed in this film. Fassbender had to sort of portray a character that was in a way sort of imploding and very within his own head and keep, you know, he had to keep quiet. And Mulligan, on the other hand, she got to sort of explode and portray a character that is in a weird way trashy a little bit, if you know, in comparison to if you've seen her in an Education or something like that. Who did a better job? Did they do equally? What do you guys think?
I thought she was unrecognizable almost from what I last saw her in, which was an Education. So, I mean, and not for, you know, any crazy costuming or, you know, prosthetics or anything. She just, I think, is good at embodying different characters. So I give her credit on that score. I feel like they had an interesting chemistry together, which worked both as brother and sister, but also with that extra dynamic, like maybe there was something romantic about it. I thought it was pretty much ideal casting.
I agree with you. I thought she was amazing. I thought she did an unbelievable job in this movie. She, in a weird way though, she had the easier character to portray. This character was somebody that explosive. You can really, as an actor, sink your teeth into something like this, while Fassbender had a much more difficult job because he had to portray everything without ever showing his cards in a way. Like, we had to get in his head, and we didn't have those moments like Mulligan had to just sort of go off the rails. I mean...
I love that there was no narration. Can I just drop in there? I feel like as I get older, I hate narration more.
Like voiceover?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say that. Sorry.
But yeah, no, I thought, I could see a nomination for Mulligan for sure, and maybe Fassbender too for this. I think, like I said, I think he had a much more difficult acting job than she did, but... She stood out above everyone else.
Yeah, he had more difficult and more, like, not recognizable as a good performance kind of...
Right, exactly. It was a quietly...
But good, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I thought they were both great. I would say, though, I thought Fassbender's performance was probably the stronger of the two. And come nomination time, I'd expect to see him nominated more than I would Mulligan. But who knows? I mean, Fassbender's in so many movies this year that look like he might get nominated for something else and not for Shame. You know what I mean?
Or he may be in too many that it's just like he cancels himself out.
Yeah,
possibly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't know. Just I would expect him to be nominated more than her. Although I think her performance was excellent. I think he carries that film so much. He's in probably just about every scene, if not every scene of the film. And, you know, it's a brave role to play. He does it excellently. And like you guys were talking about, he doesn't have those real scenes that he can really show off the acting. It's more of an implosion than it is an explosion with Carey Mulligan.
All right, so now we're going to talk about at what point sort of directors become auteurs. What point directors become recognizable, not themselves, but their work becomes recognizable as their work. And here we have a director, Steve McQueen, who is only on his second film ever. His first film was Hunger, which also starred Michael Fassbender. And he's, if you give me 1 second, he's about to make another movie, a third film called 12 Years a Slave, which also stars Fassbender and Brad Pitt. So it's his second film, and he's a director that likes to do long takes, long static takes. In Hunger, there's, I think, like a 14-minute static take at a table. In Shame, there was that date scene, which was all one static take at a table. Mm-hmm. In Shame, there's, from what I remember, it feels like there's more long tracking takes than there were in Hunger. But he's a director who definitely has a certain style, and that sort of brought up the question to me: can we even call him an auteur yet? Does he have to make more movies like this? Like, if we look back at all the great directors, if we look back at Scorsese or Kubrick or Malick, and we looked at their first two movies, we'd be like, okay, now we're on to something. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
I think it's definitely possible for for somebody to be an auteur after just a few films. I mean, you look at someone like Quentin Tarantino. And you think, you know, he made Reservoir Dogs, and his second film was Pulp Fiction, and Pulp Fiction just blew everybody away, and he kind of became like one of the biggest directors in Hollywood. So I think it's definitely, you're definitely able to become an auteur just from a few things. And actually, the first person that came to mind was Derek Cianfrance, who directed Blue Valentine. that I thought of when Jeremy first brought up the idea of doing this as a discussion. And he'd done one other movie, one other full-length narrative film, excuse me, before he did Blue Valentine. That was like in 98. It was called Brother Tide. And then he did Blue Valentine, and he's done a bunch of documentaries as well. But he was just the first one that came to mind, and I think you definitely can become an auteur after just, you know, a couple movies. You know, as, if you're putting your indelible mark on the films that you're making as a director, then I think you're an auteur no matter how many films you've made. And I think auteur kind of is like a very, you know, it's kind of like a very artsy word. It's one that kind of gets thrown around a lot. But I think, you know, if you have directors who are sticking to their guns, who are in control of their projects, and who are making the films that they want to make, I think absolutely you can call them auteurs, even if they've only done, you know, one, two, three movies.
Do the movies have to be good?
I would hope so. Otherwise, I mean, technically, I guess they don't, but I don't think you're
Russ
really going to call an
auteur. I guess Russ Meyer could be considered an auteur, if you're familiar with his work.
I guess Uwe Boll could be considered an auteur, if you're familiar with his, I guess.
Right. Well, I don't want to get into the discussion of, because once we really start breaking down auteur, it almost falls apart, because really any director can be.
But the thing is, I mean, if you're making terrible films, the term auteur is not going to be used to describe you, you
right.
know?
So let's not try and define auteur. Yeah. Let's just talk about, I guess, directors that really made an impression on filmmaking in their first couple of films. I think that's... Yeah. And I also find that a lot of those directors also seem to use the same actors early on. Tarantino does it. Scorsese mm-hmm. did it. You look here with Steve McQueen. He does it with Michael Fassbender. He's found himself an actor that he, you know, can rely on. I think there's got to be sort of a comfort level with your surroundings and the people who you work with and everybody being on the same page that you can get away with sort of making a movie like this, like Shame or like Hunger, which I personally did not really like Hunger. I know it's been touted as a great film, but I thought it lacked a certain coherence, a sort of linear drive throughout that whole film. I think Shame is a much better movie, but it's interesting to talk about this as far as these filmmakers are concerned, because there's also great filmmakers that you wouldn't even, you know, consider, you wouldn't give this label to. I don't think anyone's ever given Spielberg this label, because Spielberg or Soderbergh, all the Bergs.
Yeah. Oh, I think Soderbergh's probably been described as an auteur.
He has, but he doesn't, every movie he does is different, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's I'm sorry. No, yeah, that is a good point, because someone like, I'm even going to throw out Louis Malle, it seems his films have such a different kind of whole character to them each time that it doesn't have that.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, you know?
No, but I just, it does seem we don't attribute, you know, the title of auteur to someone who is that dynamic and different with each outing as opposed to.
So are we only talking about Steve McQueen being auteur after two movies because he has two long takes, one in each movie? I mean, that's kind of what we're. It's like our human brains are just always looking for this. Like,
it seems like he's
similar.
It seems like he's probably courting this sort of attribution to him. He's mm-hmm. he's definitely taking a lot of measures, you know, that one would probably take if they wanted to achieve status of auteur.
Is it braver as a filmmaker to try and be like, okay, so I'm gonna shoot this movie very similar to how I shot that movie because everyone liked it? Or is it braver to do, okay, this is a whole new movie, this is an entirely different story I'm telling, I'm going to shoot it the way that I think this story is best represented?
I think it's more honest to be like, well, I mean, no matter who makes the movie, they probably have certain patterns and habits and mm-hmm. technical moves that they tend to make, but, you know, the ones who are honest about it are, you know, like, just gonna go ahead and do it, as opposed to being like, oh, I don't try to package my stories in any particular way. And then you look over their work and then it's like, yeah, you've done this 7 or 8 times or whatever. So sorry, go ahead.
No, as I say, you talk about being honest and brave, and like, in a way, working with Michael Fassbender, who's a great actor now going on to his third movie, that's not really being brave. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but he's like, he knows that what Fassbender can give him performance-wise, and he sticks with it. It's just an interesting discussion to have, and I think it's kind of a discussion that you'd only have on sort of a podcast, because really, like, if Steve McQueen wants to use Michael Fassbender, who's going to ever fault him for that? But in a way, he is being, I don't know, he's not going out of his comfort zone.
I imagine it's an if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of thing. He must feel like they have a good working chemistry, and they're both up for it, so why not?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, how long did it take Scorsese to get away from using Robert De Niro in all of his films?
Or Harvey Keitel.
Or, yeah, there you go. So, I mean, just because, I mean, I think, you know, we have, like, a very limited retrospective on this because he's only done 2 films so far. But, you know, if he has this great long career a la Martin Scorsese, and, you know, after movie 2 or 3 or whatever, he hasn't used Fassbender, or Fassbender only comes back much later, you know, I think you could kind of say that he's expanded you know, his directing skills beyond relying on you know, Fassbender.
I'm gonna take a second. I'm gonna take a second before we do this and plug ourselves. We haven't done that in a while.
Oh, that sounds dirty.
Yes. All right. So it is that time, because we haven't done this in a while, but it is time to plug ourselves here over at Get Your Film Fix. We really want to encourage people to go over getyourfilmfix.com. You know, if I were to give homework assignments for plugging ourselves, maybe I should just break it down really easy. All you have to do this week for homework is go to getyourfilmfix.com and check out our articles, check out some of our older podcasts if you haven't seen them, and check out our videos up there. So getyourfilmfix.com. Just go and check it out, and if you feel like it, there's also a donate tab.
All right, so for our top five this week, we decided to go with I'm just going to start that again. That was weird. Do. That was a weird, weird thing. All right. So for this week on the podcast, we decided to go with our top five movies about addiction, since Shame is about a sex addiction. So I'm going to kick it over to you, Jeremy. Why don't you give us your number five and any criteria you had for this list?
Just had to be about addiction. That was pretty much it. And like you said earlier, Brantley, I think this was the only movie, Shame's the first movie, really, to deal with sex addiction. So I had no other ones of those. It was either alcohol or drug addiction that is on my list. And with that, my number five is the 1955 movie, The Man with the Golden Arm, starring Frank Sinatra. He's basically a junkie, and I believe is addicted to heroin, and it's a very before its time type of movie. I mean, it also kind of like hits you and goes to show you that people back in the mid-50s, I mean, this was clearly big enough to make a movie starring Frank Sinatra, were dealing with these things too. It's not a modern day problem. So it's interesting in that way, and it's a very good film. Otto Preminger directed it.
It is a very good film. It's so good it might show up on this list later on. Tease and tease. I said may. That necessarily will.
It will. Now just it so definitely you know. Will.
Yeah. Okay, well, whatever you say. All right, Michael.
Yeah, my criteria, I guess I just sort of stuck to alcohol or drugs. And oddly enough, a theme running through here is that maybe I don't love the movie, but the performances are good, or they're interesting performances. But anyway, my
you
number five.
You always get good performances in addiction movies.
Yeah.
It's like biographies.
Right, because they're just sort of in extremes at all times.
Or so. When somebody's playing retarded.
Yeah, and, well.
Whoa.
Well, no, but that's definitely, I mean, as we know, that generally leads to an Oscar nomination playing someone of a...
Addicted, but, particular, retarded, or
but the
a
thing
biography.
Is, the
or
thing
real.
Is, you don't go full. You only go...
You can say it, Brantley. You can say full retard.
No, I'm... I'll say it because it's a reference to a movie. You don't go full retard.
Oh, you are. That's come on.
I don't use the R word.
We're classier
in regular,
than that,
in
Brantley.
Regular life, sir.
All right.
Sir,
if I may.
Good
if
day.
I may.
Whatever, you're retarded.
My number five.
You're wicked retarded, Brantley.
Can I get the trolley back on the tracks here?
Fine.
My number five. I selected Gia, the Angelina Jolie.
Huh.
Film with a decent
Angelina
amount of
Jolie.
What's that?
With a decent amount of what?
Of Angelina Jolie, exactly.
Yeah.
In it. And it is about, you know, the again, it's, well, this is a twofer. It's a real life story, and it's, she's addicted.
And yes, she did not get nominated.
She did not get nominated, but she would have if she were slightly retarded, or maybe just throw a little dyslexia on her. I'm gonna pretend she had dyslexia too.
Some other struggle she had to
go
through.
That's a triple threat, Brantley.
That is a triple threat. Wasn't that? I didn't see that movie, but wasn't it just like within a few years of her doing Girl Interrupted, where she was also? Oh no, that was mental,
mental
instability.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that
that's what she needed.
Yes. Oh,
I so gotcha.
But yeah, right. I think she's strong in it, and. It's just an interesting story, and true, and Faye Dunaway's in it, who, as crappy as she might be in real life, I think she's an interesting actress.
You think Angelina Jolie's a crappy person in real life?
No, Faye Dunaway, crabby, with a B.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Sorry.
I gotcha.
My dyslexia, apparently.
There you go. Michael, you could win an Oscar. All right.
and the pod goes to...
All right,
but I'll pass the baton to you, Brantley.
Well, thank you, sir. I don't really have any criteria, just that someone in the movie has to be dealing with an addiction, so it's really right on the nose there. And so my number five is Blow with Johnny Depp and what was her name there? Is it Salma Hayek or Penelope Cruz? I'm totally blanking on whichever one that was. What's that?
You're racist. They're completely different people.
I know they are. I'm trying to remember.
You sure it wasn't Paz Vega?
It's Penelope Cruz.
Thank you. All right. Penelope Cruz was the one. I was blanking on which one of them was in the movie. But anyway, so Blow is my number five movie. In.
Was he addicted or was he just a drug dealer?
Well, he was both. He was huge dealer, but he was also addicted to it.
It's been a while since I've seen.
Yeah. He was like Scarface, kind of,
yeah,
in that sense. Well,
right.
I mean, Blow, I think is kind of underrated.
Okay,
really, I think it's overrated.
You think really? Because
yeah, I think it's like in the vein of wanting to be Scarface, wanting to be Boogie Nights, and like shot like that. But it's just it's like a poor man's version of those. It's not bad though. It's not bad.
I think it gets overlooked. I think it gets overlooked and kind of forgotten. You know what I mean? So whatever.
It's not bad. That's such a smack in the face appraisal of a movie. I'd love for you to say that to one of the directors, whoever made that movie.
Ted Demme.
Oh, right, yeah. Isn't he dead?
Let's check. Hold on, one click away.
I'm pretty sure he died.
Died January 13th, 2002 at age 38. Well, how did he die?
Drugs, I think. Apropos enough.
Wow, so that is a bit of addiction. Well, now I feel a little bit worse.
Yeah. Good.
All right, good. Now, okay, my number four. My number four is a director that we talk about a lot with admiration on this podcast, Billy Wilder. And it is his film, The Lost Weekend.
Matt, weave me another. Better take it easy.
No, don't worry about me. Just let me know when it's 6:15.
Okay.
Come on, man. Join me. One little jigger of dreams, huh?
No, thanks.
You don't approve of drinking?
Not the way you drink.
It shrinks my liver, doesn't it, Matt? It pickles my kidneys, yes. But what does it do to my mind? It tosses the sandbags overboard so the balloon can soar. Suddenly I'm above the ordinary. I'm competent, supremely competent. I'm walking a tightrope over Niagara Falls. I'm one of the great ones. I'm Michelangelo molding the beard of Moses. I'm Van Gogh painting pure sunlight. I'm Horowitz playing the Emperor Concerto. I'm John Barrymore before the movies got him by the throat. I'm Jesse James and his two brothers, all three of them. I'm W. Shakespeare. And out there, it's not Third Avenue any longer. It's the Nile, man. The Nile, and down it is the barge of Cleopatra. Come here. Purple the sails, and soul perfume that the winds were lovesick with. The oars were silver, which to the tune of flutes kept stroke.
I don't know, have either of you guys seen this movie?
Yep, sure have.
And it is a great performance, and it's a great movie, I think. I think it's one of the first movies really to deal with alcohol addiction, and it's always about a writer. Alcohol and writing go hand in hand.
They're promoted alcoholic suicide as writers.
Art imitating life, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know a writer who's not an alcoholic. I mean, all of us who write for Get Your Film Fix are hardcore alkies.
... Yes. Finish that sentence.
Although I do find it funny, Jeremy, because you were saying that Bay with the Golden Arm was kind of ahead of its time, but then The Lost Weekend was like 10 years before it, dealing with like serious
but that was
drug
alcohol.
Addiction.
That was alcohol.
Oh, alcohol.
I think there's
a drug,
difference.
Sir.
No, alcohol's I know, but I think it's there's certainly a what's the word I'm looking stigmatic difference between alcohol and drug use, especially at that time, because everyone drank. Not everyone used heroin, and it almost was never talked about.
Valid point, I think.
All right, who's
Michael's
next? Michael.
It's me, and drum roll, I have the same exact number 4 of The Lost Weekend for the same reasons, and I'm a big Ray Milland fan. I just
did he win the Academy Award for that movie?
I think it won Best Picture, but I don't know that
He won Best Actor, it won Best Director, it won Best Picture, and a Best Screenplay.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, there you go.
Interesting. All right. My number 4 is a biopic. It's called Wonderland, and it's about John Holmes in the 1980s and the Wonderland murders that happened.
That could be a sex addiction, too.
Yeah, I don't know if he necessarily has sex addiction. He's really addicted to drugs.
Yeah.
But
that outweighed any sex addiction.
Yeah, I think he had sex for money.
If you become a sex addict, you should just, as a precaution, become a drug addict so that it will outweigh.
So it doesn't look as bad.
So much less embarrassing.
Yeah. It's kind of funny but true.
Val Kilmer plays John Holmes, and he is a really... I don't know if either of you have seen the movie.
I have not.
He plays John Holmes, and he does actually a really good job of playing a very skeevy, like, John Holmes, and he plays it really, really well. So I would recommend this movie. Josh Lucas is also in it, among others, including Kate Bosworth. So just a heads up.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Sweet. All right, my number 3 is a film that I think it's lost some of its luster in the public eye over the years. But when it came out, it was an interesting film because it dealt with all aspects of the drug culture, from addiction to dealing to people who made massive amounts of money on it to people that it just killed, and that is Steven Soderbergh's Traffic.
Gotcha.
Mm.
Yeah, I thought about that one. That's on my honorable mention list. I didn't quite make my list, though.
Do you guys agree that it's sort of like when it came out, it was like, oh, this is an awesome movie, and then it's sort of become Traffic.
I mean, I remember it being, like, pretty big that year. Wasn't it the same year, like, he was nominated for Aaron Brockovich and for Traffic? Correct. Okay. Exactly. Yeah, I do remember it being, like, a pretty big movie when it first came out. Because it had that huge cast, you know, it had, like, Benicio Del Toro, and just, like, everybody was in. Topher Grace was even in it. I mean, it had, like, everybody in it. So I do remember that.
Had that big cast, Topher Grace.
Well, yeah. I mean, you had everything from Benicio Del Toro, who, like, won it. Didn't he win an Oscar for it?
Yeah, he did.
Like, all the way down to Topher Grace was also in the movie.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, it was a huge, big deal at the time. I agree.
Yeah.
But, yeah, over time, it's probably, like, meh.
And it's got its nah from no real for no real reason, you know? Like, I don't... It's still... I guess I have to see... I have to revisit it. But,
yeah.
It certainly... I mean, it seems to be certainly more about the trafficking than it is really the addiction, but it definitely has
that element
both in it. Yeah. Right. All right, Michael, you're three.
All right. Well, then my number three. I said Panic in Needle Park with Al Pacino. Again, just talking about how I like those types of performances of someone in that state of addiction, regardless of whether or not it still works as a whole film. I think he's interesting in it. And Raul Julia, who doesn't get a lot of love anymore.
He's in dead.
Yeah, he's been dead for a long time.
Been dead for a while, yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, he's not someone who, you know, posthumously gets a lot of, oh, Raul Julia, yeah, he was great. People don't seem to remember.
Well, I didn't see that movie, but wasn't Street Fighter the last Raul Julia performance?
It could be. I thought it's that or Adam's Family Values, probably.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I remember he was like the super bad guy from Street Fighter with like Claude Van Damme and stuff.
And he's in a Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode. I don't know if you've seen Overdrawn at the Memory Bank.
No, I didn't see that one.
That's a rather funny MST3K that has Raul Julia. But anyway, put Raul Julia in a slightly better environment, better writing, acting, such as Panic in Needle Park, and it's an interesting experience.
Cool. Sure. All right. I know it's on Netflix.
I'm glad we got some Raul Julia talk on this podcast, finally.
Everybody. Thank you. Yeah. Raul
Julia in it. All right. My number three is Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream from back in 2000. That is my choice at number three. It's kind of a difficult one to watch, really. I mean, the way that...
It's a no holds barred dealing with
it. Yeah, it really
you just went
really
for it.
No punches. It's all out there, and it definitely is a tough film to watch.
All right, my number two is a movie that I guess I can't say how accurate it could be for alcohol addiction, but it seemed like it was drawn on some personal experiences and by a writer who eventually died of the disease, and it is Leaving Las Vegas with Nick Cage.
I have to go. Thank you, though. Maybe you shouldn't drink so much.
Maybe I shouldn't breathe so much, Terry. Ha!
That's it, pal. We're closing up now.
I'm gonna finish this.
Yeah, it's another one that's on my honorable mentions list. I think that's Nick Cage at his finest, that, an adaptation.
Absolutely. He's amazing.
Yeah, he's very good.
That's a Nick Cage we're not familiar with much anymore. Yeah.
No, we get the Nick Cage from Season of the Witch lately.
What's sad is the writer John O'Brien, who suffered with alcohol addiction. He wrote it, and he died at age 33.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Very crazy.
Right. My number two, I selected. Again, actually, this is my second Faye Dunaway appearance on my list. Barfly, the Babbitt Schroeder, am I pronouncing that right? He's some freaking French guy. That's the director I'm speaking of. Yeah.
No, I just love
Barbet Trope. B-A-R-B-E-T. Barfly, 1987, Mickey Rourke, and Faye Dunaway. And it's, again, it's an alcohol scenario, as you probably could tell. And I think it's always nice when they can somehow mix, you know, like love relationships in with alcohol and or whatever the addiction is, and that the pain, the exquisite pain of all that, of those two things interacting.
Also done in Leaving Las Vegas with Elizabeth Shue.
There you go.
So yeah, no, it's.
I think that's why we are drawn to these sorts of movies, because of the emotions and the tensions. Boom.
Absolutely. Wait. Nice. Good job finishing that one up.
With the boom.
With the boom. Yeah, that's. It's a good point to end it on. No, my number two is a movie that's already been listed before. It was on Jeremy's list. It is The Man with the Golden Arm from 1955.
Have you seen that recently, Braley?
I saw it probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, so it's been a little while.
Does Shirley Bassey sing the main theme from that song?
I do not remember.
Don't know. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. The Man with Golden Arm. It sounds like a James Bond movie.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's the man with the golden what?
Gun.
There you go.
Yeah.
Gun.
So,
that's how they got people in the theater. They're like, yes, Frank Sinatra. Golden Arm. And then they're like, oh, awesome. Will return. Action movie.
Yeah.
Why is this super agent addicted to heroin? And why is he a drummer? Anyway, so that was that's my number two.
All right, my number one has already been mentioned, but I really think it's sort of the ultimate movie on addiction. Since then, it's been hard to really make a movie about drug addiction that really resonates as much as this film, and it is Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream. And not only is Requiem for a Dream just I don't know, maybe not accurate, but just like a very visceral, hard-hitting experience on drug addiction. It's also a fantastic film. It's fantastic filmmaking. Aronofsky's style in that movie is something that if you see it, you don't forget. I mean, he did some very innovative things. And Clint Mansell's score is something that we still hear today in like, you know, trailers for other movies and video game trailers. I mean, it was real. It's a movie that if you watch it for its filmmaking only, there's some, you know, intense filmmaking going on in that film.
Yeah.
Also, it's not just solely about this, you know, the addiction and all. Let's just concentrate. I mean, he really does some interesting things as a filmmaker in Requiem for a Dream.
Mm. All right. Yeah, true. I think thousands would agree with you on that pick for number one, if not millions. And it's funny that you should bring up music and speak specifically to that as well, because my number one for addiction movies is The Days of Wine and Roses with that Henry Mancini theme song, which has become a standard, I think. And you know, it's younger Jack Lemmon who you know, I loved those roles where he would play like a righteously indignant businessman like in The Apartment, you know, those kinds of personally tortured people. And this movie does take him all the way through his bout with alcoholism right through to the end with AA, and it also has that thing going on with the way the substance affects and ends up deteriorating his relationship with his wife. And he's awfully good in it, and it's Blake Edwards. Yeah.
It's a film I really, really want to see. I've never seen it.
Yeah, well, again, I think it's
popcorn bucket list?
Yeah, it could be for you, sure. But yeah, mainly for the Jack Lemmon. I mean, it's good, but he's it's always a treat to see him doing good work.
Is he your favorite actor ever? Or is he up there?
He's definitely up there for me, yeah.
Jack Lemmon's up there for me, too.
Yeah.
I think that guy is awesome.
I agree.
I think he was robbed
of a lot of stuff that I haven't seen of his, so I guess.
Yeah, I think he was robbed of the Oscar in Glengarry Glen Ross, man. Yeah, he's just dynamite in that performance.
Yeah, he's got such a sadness. It's all in the eyes, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's what it's about for me, the eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I'm an alcoholic. I'm not.
The sad thing is, am I the only one that's actually drinking during this podcast?
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I'm having a little
bloody
hair of the dog. Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary, nice.
My Sunday Bloody Mary.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
See, if you make it a weekly thing, it's like, oh, it's a Sunday Bloody Mary. It's fine.
No, yeah, it's like in the old days. Oh, grandmother's having her preprandial sherry before dinner. Exactly. Yeah, no, it used to be completely fine, and people got uptight, and now Fassbender's beating off every which way, you know? That's the exact chain of events.
Michael really wants to encourage more people to drink and tear down the walls.
Brantley, if Michael's encouraging them to drink, what is your number one that's going to discourage them to drink?
Just completely interrupted me right in the middle of saying the thing I was saying to Michael.
Which was?
That, you know, not only was you encouraging people to drink, but to also tear down the walls of shame that come with just being a casual drinker.
Boom. See?
Thank you. Especially in films. Yes.
I like my transition a little bit.
See how I tied that into the film we watched this week?
Yeah,
and it also goes to my number one, which you mentioned already, which is Billy Wilder's The Lost Weekend, which is about an alcoholic.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
It
damn,
sure is.
Damn straight. So,
and how?
Have you seen that in the last couple of years?
I saw that back in college. I took a Billy Wilder class, and we watched it in it. So it's been a while. I remember.
What was the name of your class in the in your course? Options. Was it called Walk on the Wilder Side?
No, but that would have been awesome. I forget. We had to take a genre and directors course, and I actually had to take two because I did a dual major. But So genres and directors, Billy Wilder. And then the other one I took was genres and directors, Samuel Fuller. So there you go. But it's an excellent film. Ray Milland gives an unbelievable performance in it as Don Burnham. And it's really powerful stuff. And I think Billy Wilder is just one of those directors who can do any genre he puts his mind to. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a war movie. It doesn't matter if it's a comedy. It doesn't matter if it's a drama. I mean, he could do just about anything. So, and he really kind of shows that off, that he can do really hard-hitting dramas with The Lost Weekend.
All right. Well, I think we had some interesting lists here.
Yep. You know, it was interesting. No one had Trainspotting on their list.
I was hoping somebody would. I think I left it off hoping that one of you would have it on there.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
Oh, really?
Really?
I know, but it's one of these things where it's like, you haven't seen Trainspotting? And then I get fuck you. I'm not
That's on your
feedback at getyourfilmfix.com.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was just one of the honorable mentions. Leaving Las Vegas was another one that was on your list there, Jeremy. I also had Permanent Midnight, Jesus' Son, and Spun as other films that didn't make my list, but that were close. So that will wrap up this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We appreciate it, and we encourage you again to check out our site, getyourfilmfix.com. You can find all of our podcasts on there, all of our articles, features, and also all of our videos. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
All right, top fives. Right. It is top five time.
Can you intro it with that British accent? Like that really struggling.
I was going to go
Cockney
for New
accent.
Zealand accent.
Yeah, I don't think it was British.
It sounded like Cockney, like 1800s, but like really like rough and tumble from the streets.
Hello, governor.
It's time to clean the chimney.
Yeah. Yes,
right,
there we go.
Right. Time for a top five. Something like
top
that.
Top five? Fuck that. Now we're in a Guy Ritchie movie.
Oh, yeah.